Welcome to day three, third and final day of our sitting this week. I'm honored to sit with Judges Englehart and Douglas. Judge Douglas did not get the bow tie memo today.
Mm-hmm. Missed it.
She missed it. But welcome, everybody. We're going to kick it off with 25-50719, Tiarena v. City of San Antonio. Mr. Ballantyne, welcome.
May it please the court. My name is Patrick Ballantyne. I'm here today representing the survivors of Nidia Tiarena, who was tragically shot and killed by a San Antonio police officer in June of 2021. I'd like to start by addressing a concession we made in our brief as to the liability of two of the three appellee officers. So given the evidence that developed over the course of discovery and given the holding of the district court, we now concede that officers Claire and Rogers did not exercise excessive force in their application of force. What we are contending is that Officer Aguirre did when he fired 9 rounds of barrier-penetrating rifle fire in less than 2 seconds at a suspect and up into an apartment wherein he knew hostages to be present. And I think that concession, or I hope that concession, is helpful and informative to the court because I believe it provides a contrast between two reasonable officers and then one officer who we contend did not act reasonably, or at least there is a genuine issue of material fact that he did not act reasonably because we are, of course, at the summary judgment stage of these proceedings.
So, quick question about your concession. So, you concede the decision to open fire was justified.
As to all three.
And that Claire and Rogers acted reasonably in that 2 second window, right?
That's correct, Judge.
So it seems that your theory has to be that the same justified volley became unreasonable, but is that about the volume of shots? Is it about the background? The backdrop, about what was behind Sanchez?
Yes, as to all, and okay. Other factors as well. So this is a little different than a lot of the police-involved shootings that may come to the court through the 1983 cause of action chain, because this case involves rifle fire. Rifles are just kind of a different animal than handguns. They behave differently, they act differently, they shoot differently, and there is evidence in the record supporting the fact that you cannot fire 9 shots out of a semi-automatic AR-patterned rifle in less than 2 seconds and maintain an accurate field of fire. And that is why Officer Aguirre's shots, the record shows, went up from the defendant, who was, I'm sorry, not the defendant, Mr. Sanchez, who was on a stairwell up into the apartment and then struck the door above him, one of those bullets striking and killing Ms. Tiarena.
Do we know what order those shots landed insofar as Ms. Tiarena is concerned? In other words, you're saying that there were, however many shots, was it one of the last ones or was it one of the first ones that struck Ms. Tiarena?
I think there's a reasonable inference based on the testimony about muzzle rise when rapidly firing an AR-15 that it was probably one of the last shots.
One of the later ones, okay.
Yes.
Well, let me also ask you, and I appreciate your opening comments because it really does focus the issue here for us. our 2019 case of Garza versus Briones, in that case there was a firing of 68 shots in 8 seconds. And a panel of this court held that that alone did not render the force unreasonable. Using that as a benchmark, in this case we have fewer shots, significantly fewer shots. Where do we draw the line on this type of thing, and can you explain why that case should not be informative here?
I believe, if I have my cases correct, I believe Briones did not involve hostages. It did not involve injury to an innocent
okay.
party. And that really is the distinguishing factor here. We're not saying he fired too many times, case closed, unreasonable. What we're saying is, given his knowledge, or the evidence suggesting that he had knowledge of hostages in the apartment directly behind his field of fire, and given the his own testimony that the hostages were moving about in and out of the apartment, firing 9 shots on a rising AR-15 rapid fire in less than 2 seconds, that was an unreasonable application of force. Or again, it raises the issue of whether it was a reasonable application of force.
If those same shots were spread across 30 seconds instead of two, would that have been
I think so, because reasonable? That's more controllable rate of fire. The timing is a factor. 9 shots in 2 seconds. I don't know if your honors have personal experience or if you would even want to bring that to this consideration, but I can tell you, and the evidence supports this, we have, but firing 9 shots from that rifle, there is muzzle rise, firing that quickly. We have testimony from SAPD training officers said they used to teach 2 shots assess, 2 shots assess. So if you're firing 9 shots or even some additional amount of shots over the course of 30 seconds, assessing the need and continuing to fire as necessary, that would be a reasonable application of force. This spray and pray 9 shots in 2 seconds is not a reasonable application. And we need only look to officers Claire and Rogers to see, well, what is another reasonable officer, or really in this case, 2 reasonable officers who have the same perspective as Aguirre, who know the same things about this whole situation that he did. They fired a relatively restrained 1 and 2 shots respectively, which a trained officer would be capable of controlling. And that's in contrast to Aguirre, and that's where we contend that the issue of whether that application of force is reasonable is raised such that it should be considered by a jury.
Can you walk me through just the chronology, the timeline of, is it Nida or Nida? I'm sorry.
Nidia is how it's
Nidia. I've heard. Of Nidia coming out of the apartment and the point at which the officers were told everybody had moved into a back room. Can you kind of step me through the timeline?
It's not entirely clear minute to minute what happened. So the officers were informed that everybody was in a back room because Nidia was making phone calls out of the house at some point and said, we're huddled up in a back room. And that was relayed to the officers. But at the same time, subsequent to that, the officers also saw Nidia coming out of the apartment. They actually saw at one point, and I can't pinpoint exactly what the when this was, I'm sorry, but at one point, Officer Aguirre, and I believe the other 2 officers also testified, that Angel Sanchez emerged from the apartment holding Nidia's infant son, thus demonstrating that the officers knew or should have known that the hostages were not confined in a location in the back of the apartment. And by the way, the back of the apartment is still in the field of fire, but they did have knowledge that the hostages were moving about the apartment and coming in and
so
out.
So the back room was still in the line of fire or off the line of fire?
My understanding of the layout is it was directly behind that apartment, or that apartment door, which was the field of fire. And Judge, I'd like to address briefly the issue of seizure, because I know this has been sort of an unresolved issue in this court, whether an innocent person who was injured by a police officer who was intending to target someone else, whether that person is seized for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment. I know I know you touched on the issue, Judge Willett, in the Estate of Parker case, but in that case, both parties seem to have agreed that the child was seized, and so it wasn't really decided. Judge Engelhardt, I think you also addressed it in the Casanova case, and you did a little more analysis on it, but I believe your holding ultimately turned onto the grounds. But what we are not contending that any time an innocent bystander is killed by an officer shooting at someone else, they are therefore seized. We think the distinguishing factor, considering Coon v. Ledbetter and other cases that give limited information about what the law is in the circuit, hold that where an officer knows that that a hostage or an innocent person is within his field of fire and fires anyway, well, that is a willful seizure. And I think there's a distinction to be made between willfully and intentionally, and whether there has to be a specific intent to actually seize the innocent person in their line of fire. I don't think that's what the Supreme Court was talking about in Brower versus County of Indio, where they say a Fourth Amendment seizure occurs even when an unintended person is the object of the police action. The action must be willful, though, as opposed to unintentional, and that's the distinction. They have to know there's an innocent person back there and know there's a risk in order for that application of force to constitute a seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Now, I will say that the appellee officers seem to have conceded the issue. In their brief, they describe the issue as moot because the district court assumed without deciding it, acknowledged that there's there's a paucity of authority at this time regarding seizure out of the Fifth Circuit. And I think that's also recognized in a case that came out in June, Martinez v. Hinojosa, which holds similarly. So we believe that a willful application of force plus the knowledge that some hostage or innocent person is in the field of fire is sufficient to invoke the Fourth Amendment seizure for that.
So we have to, I think, approach this on the facts that were knowable to the officer at the time he pulled the trigger. Is that, you agree with that, right?
I do.
The radio had confirmed, I think several times, that everyone inside had moved to a back room, which I had thought, maybe I misread, I thought was off his line of fire, but you say maybe not. Maybe that's not true.
There was a room to the right of the field of fire. If that's the room they're talking about they were in, then yes, it was outside the field of fire.
All right. I'm just kind of testing the premise that he was firing into this hostage-filled doorway or area, whether that is what he reasonably believed at the time.
Well, Judge,
given the radio messages he received.
Yes, and the radio messages, I'll concede, are helpful for the defendant officers, the appellee officers. But we're at the summary judgment stage. There is evidence that contradicts their knowledge or calls into question, and specifically the officer's own testimony that they knew hostages were moving about, and they saw Ms. Tejada coming in and out of that apartment at least twice, and saw Angel Sanchez bring the infant out at least once. And so that's a contradiction, or at least calls that knowledge into question such that it should be submitted to a jury and not found to be fact as a matter of law by a court. That's our contention today. And I want to touch on the issue of excessive force, and then in the time I have left, touch on qualified immunity. I've already kind of mentioned, we believe that the two officers who acted reasonably in their application did not exercise excessive force, and that may inform the court, or at least raise that issue of material fact about whether Officer Aguirre's spray and pray application of force actually was excessive and unreasonable. On the matter of qualified immunity, the Officer Appelli's brief, I don't think acknowledged the particular statute that we're relying upon. We do, of course, rely on Grinstaff v. Barger, which I understand this court decided 40 years ago and then seems to have regretted it ever since. But Grinstaff actually talks about their Texas Penal Code 905, which says if you recklessly kill an innocent person in your application of force, you are not entitled to the justifications contained in Chapter 9 of the Penal Code, which includes self-defense and defense of others. That is a law, and what we usually talk about qualified immunity in the context of developing case law and how clear was this case law and how closely analogous were the facts, but it can also be a statute. It's not often a statute, but the cases consistently hold that it can be a statute providing for the unlawful conduct. We think 905 is squarely on point in that reckless in Texas means an awareness of a substantial and unjustifiable risk and acting and taking that risk anyway. That is reckless behavior.
Cite for me the case or cases where we've relied on a state law to overcome qualified immunity?
I can say Grinstaff was one of those cases, and it directly cites 905, so that would be the one that I would be standing on.
Okay.
Was Aguirre actually aware of this law? Because that's another question. We tend to infer that, you know, our defendants, officers, do they know about this case law? Is it clearly enough? Well, the evidence shows he was actually given this law in his training. He was actually aware of it. We don't have to glean any inference. He was actually aware of that law. And in my final moments, unless your honors have any questions about the qualified immunity issues, then in my final moments, I do want to address, the city did brief the Monell claims in this case. The court never reached them beyond the question of whether there was a constitutional violation. And so I in my reply brief, I did address all the city's responses to the Monell claims, but we don't believe it's appropriate for the court to reach those. We think if you are going to find for our claims, then this matter should be remanded to the district court for further consideration of the city's motion for summary judgment on that. And if your honors have no questions, I will yield my last 40 seconds back to the court.
Okay. Mr. Ballantyne, thank you. Mr. Kasanovich?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you very much.
Okay, welcome.
Mark Kasanovich, on behalf of Applebee's John and Geary, Jose Clare, and Nicholas Rogers, may it please the court. There's one of the issues that was brought up initially was the actual seizure, which was not really reached by the trial court on this case. We believe that the seizure did not occur in relation to Nida T. Arena because there was not an intent to seize her. I don't plan on spending a lot of time on that argument unless the court has any specific questions. But I believe the estate of Parker case kind of put to rest the issue of whether that was resolved or not in the, and it's not been resolved, whether an unintentional, somebody who's not intended to be the target would have a seizure under the Fourth Amendment when they were not the intended target. But in relation to the Singleton versus Casanova case, this court did, it's an unpublished opinion, it did kind of go towards the direction that you would have to show an intent to seize. But the court really didn't get to the final resolution of that issue. It's my understanding, based on there was probably a fact question as to whether or not the three individuals in the house were actually intended to be shot at. And there was some evidence in the record that supports.
And I think in Parker, we didn't resolve seizure outright. We just assumed without deciding.
And that's exactly what the trial court did in this case. But moving on, Your Honor, to the issue of excessive force, obviously they've conceded the point that the actual decision to use force was justified. Moving forward, then you have to go to their next argument, which is, well, he just fired too many shots in a short amount of time. This exact same issue, Your Honor, was actually decided in the Plumhoff case, which is a Supreme Court case. And if you actually look at that case, they frame the issues almost identically to this case, that the individual, the 15 shots that were fired in Plumhoff, and I will concede that that case involved a vehicle as opposed to a gunfire, but a vehicle is a deadly weapon. It can be a deadly weapon. So in the Supreme Court clearly held that an officer is entitled to use force to fire at an individual until that individual or that suspect is no longer a threat. And I don't
think
there's...
Was it the same type of weapon, and does it matter?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was it the same type of weapon that is at issue in this case, and does that matter?
It was not a weapon. It was a vehicle, okay, in Plumhoff. And it doesn't matter, because if a threat is a threat, you have the right to use that force until the threat is no longer posing a threat to either the officer or a third party.
And you say that assault would be true even if the weapon, even if firing too quickly with that weapon is not, you're not able to ensure accuracy with rapid.
Your Honor, going down this trail of this accuracy argument, there's nothing in the record that shows that this rifle was going up or he lost control of it. As a matter of fact, the uncontroverted evidence is Officer Aguirre placed his shots at center mass towards this individual. And remarkably, Mr. Sanchez was struck six times and was still not killed. He was able to crawl back in, but as soon as he dropped down to the ground, the firing ceased. But getting back to the point, there is no case law, and I haven't been able to detect one case anywhere that says an officer is limited in the amount of shots that they can fire based on the fact that they might not be able to control or have accurate fire. I think that's going down a very dangerous path, because you would have multiple situations where an officer might not have the ability to control or to guarantee accuracy, like something out of a Hollywood movie. Officers have to move, they have to run, they would have to shoot, and then all of a sudden does it become, well, you fired too many shots and you weren't accurate enough. The test is very simple. The test is very clear. Did the individual pose a threat while the gunfire occurred?
Well, counsel opposite cites as support for his case the fact that two other officers discharged weapons a lot less, maybe one shot each or so, and that there's a distinction there. Is there any material difference from the positioning of the three officers that would justify or suggest one firing more than the other two?
Your Honor, if you look at the video, you can see one of the officers is further off to the left-hand side. Officer Geary is further to the right. Aguirre and Clare are pretty much in line with one another. And directly in front of Aguirre and Claire is the door. So Sanchez comes out the door. Rogers is shooting more from the left, and I'm motioning this way. What has been misstated and mischaracterized continually in this case is that somehow, some way, these individuals were in the line of fire in the back bedroom. If you look at the summary judgment evidence, these officers all say the room is off to the far right of their sight picture. They're all in that room, and he comes out in front of them. There's nobody in the line of fire here, Your Honor. There's nobody back behind her. As a matter of fact, all of them testified we never saw anybody come around him when we fired at her. So the basic information they had at that point in time was she and the children were still in the room, and then the radio transmission says he's coming out and wants to die. The other rabbit trail that we've kind of gone down in this case, and they've repeatedly said this, and it's pretty much a false narrative, is that somehow she was out in the area beforehand. That is true. She was out in the area well before this shooting ever occurred. Then she goes back inside the house. They're inside the house for quite a long time. The helicopter comes. You see the video. That's when there comes over the radio, hey, she's in the back room. So there's no point in time do they ever fire at anybody who would even be remotely in the line of fire in that back bedroom. It's just completely dispelled by the affidavits. It's completely dispelled by the attachments. We've actually put in through the record diagrams that show exactly where the gunfire went from where they were positioned at and where they were in that house or in that apartment.
In your brief, you say the evidence is, use the phrase, equally susceptible to the inference that the other officers' shots are what killed the hostage and not Aguirre's shots. Does that prove that a jury could reasonably make either inference?
No, Your Honor. The only thing that evidence shows is a bullet fragment was found outside of, by her body someplace. That was the bullet fragment that they were able to identify that it had come from Aguirre. There's no evidence in the record that that bullet fragment ever went inside of her body. There's no evidence in the record how that bullet fragment even got there, because we know that
What did you mean in your brief? Did I misread it? Because I thought your brief said the evidence was equally susceptible to the inference that the other officer's shots killed her.
Well, that it came from someplace else. I guess that's my argument, is that they're trying to make this inference that his bullet was the one that killed her, but the opposite of that is it could have been somebody else's bullet that killed her. That's my whole point. And that results in basically no evidence, that you would not have evidence. And it's basically what's based upon a reasonable inference. There's nothing other than bullet fragment being found outside her body. Main issue, Your Honor, is putting that body, that bullet is the one that killed her. That's nothing more than speculation. Okay. So the other issue that is often overlooked in this case is Mr. Sanchez. Before the shooting, the officers were told while they were going there, and I believe while they were there, was that he was actually wearing a bulletproof vest. So another issue that comes up is what amount of gunshots would be able to take him down? Clearly, we know the one and the two shots by Claire and Rogers were insufficient. And we don't know which bullet actually in the line of succession or the succession of fire even struck Miss Tijerina. But all of that aside, there's in the district court's opinion was very clear that they cannot point to any controlling authority that firing at Mr. Sanchez that day, regardless of the number of shots, would have been a violation of the law. And to the point that I guess they're arguing at some level that there's a state statute that says, well, you acted recklessly. We don't contend in any way or concede in any way that these officers acted recklessly. They acted in accordance with the rapidly evolving situation where you have an individual coming out of a house and pointing a long gun at several officers down by a shed who could have potentially was in the process of probably going to pull the trigger, and those two officers weren't able to react. The officers down by the shed, the evidence and uncontroverted evidence is those individuals were actually going to shoot Mr. Sanchez, but for the rock, the fire from the officers on the roof. That's how much in fear of their lives they were on that day. So we have no evidence, we have no controlling authority that shooting Mr. Sanchez would have been a violation of the law. And we need no probably look even no further than the estate of Parker case, which this course I know is very familiar with. In that case, the individual was actually holding the infant in his arms when the officer shot him. The infant had no, there was no intent to strike that infant when the officer shot. And I will point out in that case, as a matter of fact, they were at a much closer range. There were actually 10 officers, I believe, involved in the estate of Parker case. And I don't believe the opinion discussed the number of rounds that were fired, but I believe there were 10 officers, and I believe all 10 of them fired at Mr. Sanchez. Now, I went back and I listened to the oral argument. There was some discussion, I believe, this is perhaps outside the record a little bit, but I believe they said that there were 17 shots fired in that case. I have not looked at the briefing in that case to verify that. But we know in that case, at least 10 shots were fired at close range while the individual was holding an infant. This court, the courts are very familiar with its holding in that case, did not find that there was a constitutional violation. If there was no constitutional violation in that case, it's hard-pressed to find that there was any established law putting Officer Aguirre on notice that him firing at Mr. Sanchez on that day, regardless of the number of shots that were fired, would have been an unconstitutional act or a violation of any law. Again, we don't concede any way that he acted recklessly. In relation to the bystander claims, there's absolutely zero evidence, again, that any of these officers fired their weapons at any of the individuals in the back room. The individuals, the summary judgment record clearly indicates and demonstrates that some of them didn't even know what happened, and they were unaware that their mother was actually killed until much later on in the evening, well after the events had occurred. So there would be no basis for a liability claim there against them and their individual, for the bystander claims. With that, Your Honor, if there are any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them, but I will give my remaining 2 minutes back to the court.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kasanovich.
Thank you.
We'll hear now for the attorney for the City of San Antonio, Ms. Correa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Cassandra Correa, and I'm here on behalf of the City of San Antonio. As Mr. Kasanovich just argued, the district court held that there was no constitutional violation. If the court were to affirm on that basis, it would have no option but to also affirm for the City of San Antonio, because absent an underlying constitutional violation, there can be no liability. However, if the court were to find a constitutional violation, I think as Mr. Ballantyne insinuated, we have raised an alternative basis in our brief that there is no evidence of a municipal policy or custom for which the city could be held liable under Monell. And under this court's precedence, the court can affirm the district court's judgment on any legally sufficient ground supported by the record, even one not relied upon by the district court. The plaintiff alleges claims for inadequate training, inadequate supervision, and inadequate discipline. As this court knows, the elements of those claims are virtually identical. You have to first have an inadequacy, so an inadequacy in the training, supervision, or discipline. It had to be causally connected to an actual constitutional violation, and the city had to be deliberately indifferent to the Harinos' constitutional rights. There is no evidence of any of those elements in this case. The Harina can prove deliberate indifference in two different ways. First, she could show a pattern of sufficiently similar constitutional violations and also sufficient in number to prove a pattern. She cites only two incidents, the Roundtree incident and the Prescott incident, which doesn't even involve the SAPD. In the Roundtree incident, which does involve the SAPD, it's distinguishable because in that incident, it involved an officer who shot into a room where he himself observed multiple other people in the room, and there was also a dispute about whether or not a gun was seen by the officer or even pointed at the officer in that incident. Contrast to the case here where Sanchez actually pumped and pointed a shotgun at the officers, and where only minutes prior to the shooting, the officers received dispatch communication that all the hostages were in a back bedroom. The plaintiff cites no other cases to show a pattern of any prior constitutional violations by the officers in this case. The second way she could prove deliberate indifference is a single incident exception, which has been used one time by the Fifth Circuit in the Brown case. It applies only where there is a complete absence of training. We've recited in our briefs the extensive training the officers had. They received TCOL training, which under this court's precedence is adequate as a matter of law, unless the plaintiff identifies defects in that state training, which she doesn't do. So there is no complete absence, and she can't rely on the single incident exception. She offers no evidence linking any alleged failure in training to any constitutional violation in this case. And again, because there is no pattern, certainly not sufficient in number or specificity, she can't prove deliberate indifference. In essence, what the plaintiff is attempting to do is manufacture municipal liability by targeting a lack of specialized training for this specific narrow fact pattern. But as this court has clearly established, the absence of specialized training does not equate to a constitutionally deficient training program. There is insufficient evidence to find any sort of policy on behalf of the city, either under the deliberate indifference standard for the inadequate training claim or for a pattern or for the single incident or inadequate supervision or inadequate discipline claims. And lastly, I'll just touch on ratification. The Fifth Circuit has found ratification in only extreme circumstances and has reiterated repeatedly that ratification is limited to extreme factual situations. Specifically to this case, this court has held that incidents similar to this do not cross the grand staff line. Finally, it appears that she dropped her bystander claim as to the city, but to the extent that she didn't, the district court determined because there was no underlying constitutional violations, the officers could not be held liable. The case cited by plaintiff with Kuhn fails to support her case because the children are not within the purview of the gunfire. The officers were firing at Sanchez, who was outside the home. So for these reasons, we'd ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. And I have 48 seconds left, so okay. I submit my time back to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Correa. Mr. Ballantyne, you're back for five.
Thank you. Good. Probably won't need all of them, but... let me just start by addressing the city's claims. Again, we think the proper route of that should be remand for consideration of those claims. However, if the court does wish to entertain the Minot claims, they are fully briefed in our reply brief, and I would refer you to that. So hearing Mr. Kasanovich, my friend's argument, I would have to say, look, you can only affirm the district court if you hold that no reasonable juror could find that Officer Zaguirre's application of force was reasonable. You have to find, to hold that as a matter of law, you have to find that no reasonable juror could ever find that, that there is not a scintilla of evidence raising the issue as to whether his force was reasonable. And to do that, you have to disregard all of the non-movements, our evidence, showing that the officers knew Ms. Tarquino was moving about the apartment at the time. Now, is that conclusive? No, I don't have to be conclusive at this point. I need only raise the issue, and that evidence raises the issue. You have to hold that that's less than a scintilla of evidence to even raise the issue of Aguirre's knowledge of persons moving about the apartment. You have to hold that an officer who fires 9 rounds in less than 2 seconds out of a high-velocity rifle into an apartment where the evidence shows he may know hostages to be present, you have to hold that that's reasonable as a matter of law, and that no reasonable juror could ever find that that's unreasonable. That's just not the standard on summary judgment, Your Honors. And I mean, the bullet fragment, I think, is a prime example of the misunderstanding of how summary judgment and the standard works. My friend says that, well, we don't know. There was a bullet fragment found under Ms. Tirajina, but we don't know who fired it. Well, maybe my definition of reasonable inference differs, but if you have a bullet under a woman who's just been shot, is it conclusive? I don't know. Is it a reasonable inference? Heck yeah. So that's the standard we're dealing with, and that's the standard I'm asking the court to apply. We are simply asking for this court to allow us to put these very important issues before a jury. A woman is dead. A family is left without a mother. I know why most of these cases get poured out in 12B6 motions and summary judgment because most of them don't have good basis in fact or law. This one does, Your Honors, and we're asking you to allow us to put these issues before a jury, and therefore we do pray you reverse the court's order of summary judgment with regards to Officer Aguirre and the city while affirming as to Officer Rogers and Claire.
Thank you, Mr. Ballantyne. We appreciate the arguments of counsel, and the case is submitted.